Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The British Embassy in Washington, D.C. looks a little bit like a modern-day Downton Abbey. It's got this impressive brick facade, lots of chimneys.
It is everything you want the British Embassy to be. It's the stately Georgian mansion with fancy art, and you expect there to be corgis running around and butlers and things.
Slate's Josh Keating has been inside for the occasional Christmas party.
They're nice parties. There's some kind of scotch display at the last one I went to. They had this like special scotch bar set up.
And presiding over the scotch bar was Kim Derrick, who until yesterday was the British ambassador, a career civil servant. He wasn't exactly known as a firebrand.
You know, I've been to a couple like briefings there. He would do these sort of off the record roundtables. And, you know, he was always very respectful and complimentary of the Trump administration, never even got close to saying anything controversial. And now I know he was saving all his hot takes for the bosses back in London.
Derrick's hot takes could mostly be found in diplomatic cables, confidential cables, cables that leaked earlier this week. Have you read the cables or what's been reported about what's in them?
Well, I've read the Daily Mail write-up of them, the extremely long Daily Mail article. It seems to go on forever. You know, first of all, this is what a diplomat is supposed to do. They're supposed to be very polite and deferential and sociable in public. And then in their cables, they're supposed to give the unvarnished truth to their bosses back in London.
The details in these memos. The details stung. He called Trump inept, said the president radiates insecurity, which is why President Trump went onto Twitter and called Derrick wacky and stupid. And after all that, it only took a few days for Derrick to announce he'd be resigning.
Yeah, and he was a sir. He was Sir Kim Derrick, too.
Does that mean he's knighted?
Yeah.
Well, he'll always have that.
Yeah, yeah. Bon voyage, Sir Kim.
Today on the show, Josh is going to explain why it matters that the leaders in the United States and the UK have started calling each other names. There's a backstory to this diplomat's sudden departure. And in Britain, there's an election at stake. I'm Mary Harris. You are listening to What Next. Stick with us. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Can you characterize Derek a little bit, like who he was in Washington? It sounded like he was very connected and, you know, like a real insider.
Yeah, he was very connected, very career foreign service. He had been national security advisor in the UK at one point. He had had various, jobs in Brussels for the EU. Very experienced diplomat, very professional. I mean, not somebody with much of an ideological agenda. I'd say a conventional ambassador in very unconventional times, both in Washington and back home in London.
Yeah, he sounds like almost milquetoast.
Yeah, milquetoast is fair to say.
But Sir Kim Derrick got to have a little more swagger in his diplomatic cables. Pundits loved to analyze Trump. So did Derrick.
I liked when he compared his ability to survive scandals to Arnold Schwarzenegger in the Terminator movies. I thought that was a good that was a good line. But, you know, again, this is, you know, as we saw in WikiLeaks, this is the kind of thing that diplomats normally send. I mean, often the tone of these cables, it's, you know, there's some snark, it's a little gossipy. I'd say that this is kind of par for the course and certainly not the kind of thing someone would normally lose their job over unless it gets published in the Daily Mail.
Yeah, and unless you have someone who's pretty thin-skinned at the helm as well, because Trump's response was immediate and very, very extreme.
Right. He called Derek stupid and wacky, and it took the opportunity to once again criticize Theresa May, as he has consistently, and talked about what a bad job she did with Brexit, and now she should have taken his advice. So it was almost, you know, Theresa May's only going to be in office for another 2 weeks or so, and she may have thought that after Trump's last visit to London, she was finally done with this kind of thing. But it looks like Trump had an opportunity to take one last shot at her on her way out the door.
You know, you said your favorite part was this part where Derek compares Trump to the Terminator, basically saying he emerges from the fire of scandals, scarred, but still alive, still in motion. He just keeps going. And it made me wonder, why wouldn't Derek try to do the same thing? Why bow out from his position?
Well, what I think really tipped the balance for him was that Boris Johnson, who is considered likely now to become the next prime minister in a couple of weeks, refused to say that he would keep Derek in his job, refused to back him. That was a contrast to Theresa May, the current prime minister, and to Jeremy Hunt, who's both Derek's boss and the guy running against Johnson. So, the fact that the next prime minister or likely next prime minister wouldn't commit to keeping him and wouldn't stand up for him is probably what finally tipped the balance and made it clear that Derek had to leave.
Can we talk a little bit about how these cables came out? Because this wasn't like a WikiLeak. It wasn't a data dump in that way. These came out in a really long Daily Mail article with excerpts from these cables. First of all, I didn't know cables were still how people were communicating between the UK and the United States. But second of all, it wasn't as if we got our hands on the raw cables. It was filtered through the Daily Mail and filtered through a very particular journalist. Can you tell us a little bit about the woman who published these cables and what that meant to you?
Yeah, this looked like a very targeted leak. And it as you said, it went to Isabel Oakeshott, writing for the Daily Mail. She's a sort of right-wing journalist. She's thought to be, or it is close to sort of promoters of Brexit, including Nigel Farage and his circle. So, you know, what this really looked like was it was clearly leaked from within the Foreign Office, perhaps, you know, by somebody looking to take out the sort of softer, non-Brexit supporting elements of the Foreign Office. I mean, and maybe it could have been a sign of some disloyalty to Jeremy Hunt, who's running against Johnson and is a former Remainer, is considered a little softer on Brexit. So this may have been an opportunity to both, you know, embarrass Jeremy Hunt and to give Boris Johnson a pretext to kind of clear the decks and appoint a kind of Brexit hardliner and somebody who Trump would like in that position.
Because the timing of this is really interesting. How many days are left until we're electing a new prime minister?
Yeah, so they're currently in the midst of a leadership contest, which is being done by mail, by paid members of the Conservative Party. And the results are supposed to be announced sometime the week of July 22nd. So we're just a couple weeks away. And so this is very quickly going to become the next prime minister's problem.
And what would the motivation be here? I mean, you mentioned the idea of sort of cleaning house, where giving cables like this to a pro-Brexit journalist would, in a way, try to motivate, you know, getting rid of anyone who might be a softer member of the team and clear the way for the new prime minister, assumably Boris Johnson, who's a Brexiteer, to put in place someone who's really going to be on his team. But it seems like such a messy way to do that.
You know, another theory out there comes back to Nigel Farage, the leader of the Brexit Party and a leading campaigner for Brexit. He's also very close to Donald Trump. He actually acted as a Trump campaign surrogate in 2016, spoke at a few rallies on his behalf in the U.S. And Trump said right after his own election that he thought Farage would be a great ambassador from the U.K. to the U.S. Theresa May's government sort of politely declined that, and Derek got to keep his job. So there's that idea that, you know, Johnson could potentially appoint Farage to this job as a kind of goodwill gesture to Trump. You know, Johnson probably doesn't actually like Farage that much. You know, his whole candidacy is premised on the idea that, you know, by voting for a populist like Johnson, they can stop conservative voters from voting for Farage. But this would be a kind of way to bring him into the tent a little bit. And also, like, shipping him off to Washington's not a bad way to kind of get him out of your hair. If he's across the Atlantic, he can't make as much trouble for Johnson as Johnson tries to negotiate a new Brexit treaty and you know, do all the things that he needs to do in what's going to be a very packed first few months of his time in office.
This bears repeating because the story is a little confusing. What's going on in the background of this ambassadorial dust-up is an election for prime minister. Boris Johnson is running against Jeremy Hunt. And the two men are really different.
Jeremy Hunt is the current foreign secretary. He took over from Johnson. Johnson left that job because he disagreed with Theresa May's Brexit strategy. Jeremy Hunt is probably more of like an establishment political insider. He was a Remainer during the Brexit referendum. He's since, you know, said he now supports Brexit, but he's someone much more likely to delay Brexit, to seek a sort of softer option that keeps Britain in a closer economic alignment with Europe. Johnson is a former journalist, former mayor of London, you know, is much more of a media figure, much more kind of voluble and
he's scandal plagued, sort of in the same way Trump is.
Absolutely, and close to Trump, and then they get compared frequently, and he kind of has that Terminator quality as well, where the kind of scandals that doom other politicians and the kind of gaffes that other politicians get in trouble for just seem to bounce off him because people assume, well, that's Boris being Boris. He's the front runner because, again, this is, you know, a vote among the Conservative electorate or Conservative Party members. They are very strongly pro-Brexit. They don't really trust Jeremy Hunt, and they think that, you know, Johnson is much more likely to deliver what they voted for, which is a real clean break with the EU.
So you've just said this is a vote among Conservative Party members. I feel like we need to explain how this election for prime minister even works.
Yeah, so it's not even really comparable to a U.S. primary because these aren't the people who voted conservative in the last election. These are about 160,000 people who pay £25 a year to be members of the Conservative Party. And altogether, it's about 0.002% of the national population. And, you know, not surprisingly, these people, they skew much older, much whiter, much more heavily male, and much richer than the public at large. They tend to be much more economically and socially conservative, and they tend to have pretty hardline views on Brexit compared to the population at large. So this is a very small slice of the population that's deciding not only the next prime minister, but, you know, possibly the direction the country is taking for, you know, the next decade or so.
And why are only Conservative Party members voting?
Well, this isn't a general election. This is because Theresa May stepped down, but the Conservative Party is still the governing party. They haven't called a new general election, which means that the party is selecting a new leader, and that leader therefore becomes the new prime minister. And so basically what happened over the last few weeks is members of parliament chose among a wide slew of candidates and narrowed them down vote by vote to the final two. And then those final two go to the party membership, who vote by mail on who the new leader is going to be. And, you know, that person, that result is going to be announced sometime the week of July 22nd.
And at this delicate moment, President Trump can spur a British ambassador to resign, because leaders in the UK are struggling with something a lot of world leaders are struggling with. They're trying to figure out how to keep Trump happy. In the same tweets he sent out calling Kim Derrick a pompous fool, Trump mentioned Brexit, calling it a disaster. It seemed like this reminder that the UK needs the US, especially when it comes to trade.
Part of the impetus behind Brexit is that if the UK leaves the EU, it'll be able to negotiate its own trade deals with other countries. And, you know, the biggest one of those is the US. And Trump has indicated he's supportive of that. He's talked about what a great trade deal the UK is going to get with the US as soon as it can complete Brexit. But, you know, given his general attitude towards trade deals, he's probably going to insist on some pretty stringent terms. And there are some controversial things that the U.S. is going to want. You know, Trump's not going to make this easy for him. And that's part of the reason why I think that, you know, Johnson and the people around him are, and Theresa May as well, were so desperate to keep Trump happy and keep him on their side. But Trump hasn't always made it easy for them.
Yeah, you wrote something that really stood out to me. You wrote that, you know, the UK is dealing with the fact that, you know, they have to have this close relationship with the US, but flattery isn't a great way to get Trump to do what you want.
Yeah, and I think this is a misperception people have. And you read this a lot, that this idea that, oh, yeah, the way to handle Trump is to just flatter him and compliment him. And actually, that was what Kim Derrick said, too, in his cables. But I think it's a little mistaken. And I think it comes from the idea that people think that, you know, Trump likes these dictators like Putin and Kim Jong-un because they're nice to him and they say nice things to him and they write him flattering letters. I mean, I'm sure he does like being flattered, but ultimately Trump's going to do what he wants. I mean, there are several leaders who have tried this. I mean, Emmanuel Macron of France, like, impressed Trump with the Bastille Day parade so much that Trump wanted to have a military parade of his own. And at the time, there were articles calling Macron the Trump whisperer and talking about this great bromance they had. But, you know, the bromance didn't stop Trump from pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, didn't stop him from pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And plenty of leaders have had the same experience. I mean, Shinzo Abe of Japan has gone overboard. I mean, it seems like every few months he's coming over here to play golf in Florida with Trump. And it hasn't, you know, stopped Trump from doing what he wants on trade. I mean, Trump talks all the time about how much he likes Xi Jinping and what great friends they are. We're still in the middle of a trade war. You know, I think that if, you know, Boris Johnson or Nigel Farage or whoever have this idea that if they just give Trump what he wants and flatter him and are nice to him and appoint an ambassador who he likes and who he'll be buddies with, that Trump will give them favorable terms on a trade deal or something, that's they got another thing coming, because that's not how Trump thinks of trade deals.
I know you were really struck by this story. Like, it really, you cover all of the world for Slate, but I know that this story in particular got your attention. And I'm wondering if you can articulate why. Why did this one kind of grab you by the collar?
I think it crystallized a lot of things about the way Trump conducts foreign policy. And there are a lot of sort of aspects of this era that found their way into this story. I mean, the Twitter component of it, most obviously, the sort of salacious tabloid aspect of it, the, you know, that this came out of leaks, that it was kind of a populist versus establishment showdown, the degree to which Trump tramples on traditional norms of statecraft and diplomacy, the extent to which he feels comfortable just sort of wading into the domestic politics of other countries and giving his opinion whenever he sees fit. There are just so many aspects of this kind of era of foreign policy that were on display here that made it a very kind of neat encapsulation of this era for me.
Josh Keating, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Keating is Slate's foreign affairs writer. He just wrote a book, too. It's called Invisible Countries, Journeys to the Edge of Nationhood. All right, that's the show. What Next is hosted by me, Mary Harris. It's produced by Mary Wilson, Jason DeLeon, and Ethan Brooks. Did you like this episode? Did you not like this episode? You want to talk about it? Tweet at me. I'm at Mary's Desk. If you want to keep the conversation going, click on over to The Gist. They are our daily show sibling here at Slate. Today, Mike Pesca is going to be talking to Will Wilkinson. He's the author of the paper, The Density Divide. They're going to chat about how populism was a surprising side effect of urbanization. Really? You're kind of curious now, right? All right. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.